Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
It is football showtime. Later on, we'll be talking to Rob Daly, Borussia Dortmund. 6 points clear in the Bundesliga. But first, Pat Nevin is standing by. Hello.
How are you doing? Are you okay?
Yeah, very well. Are you an avid Bundesliga watcher? Do you have time to watch Bundesliga on top of everything else?
I get very little time to watch that. Watch the big games in just about any league that I can get to see them, but it's very on and off at the moment.
Yeah, same. So we're going to talk about that later on. Am I hearing a hint of a cold in your voice there, Pat? The Scottish winter getting to you?
Actually, I could not speak 2 days ago, which a nation rejoiced. But no, I couldn't speak. Lost my voice completely. Wasn't very well at all. So this is a massive improvement from what you can actually almost understand a word I can say, which is different from usual, I suppose. But yeah, it's everyone I know has got this. Everyone I know has had it. It's terrible. It's absolutely sweeping the UK.
Okay. Well, it can stay over there. I think we're doing semi-okay in this office. So were you on the couch watching the weekend's football? Was that the plan, pretty much?
Yeah, that was my problem. I couldn't get out to a game. I was, which is kind of okay, because you sat and watched the stuff that interested you, and you're not travelling places. The Man United Arsenal, or the Arsenal Man United game was interesting. I was very intrigued to watch Higuain play for Chelsea to see what sort of difference he would make. But the rest of the FA Cup, obviously there were a couple of surprises in there. But the rest of the FA Cup, I don't know. It's every year it seems to be the same. A few big teams get knocked out early, but a couple of them get through. And then when they get to the last stages, they bring out the big guns. And then you end up with two big guns in the final. It's kind of weird the way it always seems to work roughly the same way at the moment.
We've just had the draw, so Manchester United or Chelsea will cancel the other out, and Man City, you would think, are odds on to make a final, depending on the draw, clearly. So that's where we are at the moment. It does mean, by the way, Manchester United's fixtures from the 12th of February go as follows. PSG at home, Chelsea then in the FA Cup, then Liverpool at home, then draw breath away to Crystal Palace, which is not that easy, then at home to Southampton, and then go again away to PSG, away to Arsenal, and at home to Man City. Over to you, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Yeah, the chances are, the way it's looking just now, they're in the conversation, as we've said before, by the time that happens, but, you know, find out all about it then. The good thing is that they look around that league just now, and, you know, do Chelsea look as if they can go in a big long run? Probably not. Do Spurs? Absolutely not, with the injuries they've got. And Arsenal, they're like world beaters 1 minute and then pretty useless the next minute. So Manchester United actually and the rest of them can afford to lose a few points here and there and drop those. And the thing is about them, now that everyone seems to be firing, they've actually got quite a lot of players on the bench that they can bring in. They all want to play as well. Mm. And that's the weird thing. You can bring Lukaku off the bench. They can start him and it looks okay. Mm. Rashford's fine, you know, start or bench. Keep on going through it. Martial, completely and utterly rejuvenated player. Thank goodness for that, because he is a fantastic football player. It was horrible to sit and watch what he was going through, but he seems to be rejuvenated now. But they've got plenty of strength and depth there. So, you know, might not be good enough, you know, particularly at the back to stop PSG. You know, if Neymar is back, which is a bit of an if at the moment, isn't it?
It seems like a huge if, yeah. They're at the point of ruling him out. And he may miss. He may well miss the second leg as well, seems to be the word.
Yeah, well, that's a massive one for them. And for once, I believe he actually is injured this time, which sounds a bit cruel, but there you go. It's just true. So, you know, they're in a situation, oddly now, where I still think they've got that momentum of a gang. And, you know, it's the same in every sport. Nothing to lose. Don't care. Written off. It's all right now. We can relax. And you can see they're almost playing without any pressure at all. Now, that eventually will come back. But they might well be right in there, you know, absolutely, maybe even third, fourth, by the time that pressure starts to kick in with them. But I definitely think they're absolutely on the up. And that was a terrible draw for Chelsea. And you're not a bad one for Manchester United. They'd rather have obviously been Old Trafford, but I mean, for Chelsea, that's a really bad draw for them.
It was notable. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer said he played the team videos of Manchester United of old beating Arsenal of old, as in he literally said he played them the Wayne Rooney, Ronaldo, Park Ji-sung goal where they go the length of the pitch. And, well, there were similar patterns at play on Friday night, which is quite extraordinary, isn't it?
I suppose you could say this is how I want you to play, and exactly this way. And you're right about the way they broke at that sort of pace. And I suppose if you can put a picture in players' minds, that's fair enough. You do it in the training ground, everybody knows. But when you're doing the training ground, the opposition know what you're going to do as well. So it's all a bit fake. So if you can sit and see something from the past that you think's that similar, and you can say, right, this is exactly it. This is how we want to do it. We've got the pace to break in them. And to be fair, it's been a while. I've thought Manchester United have been capable of doing this and using their pure pace on the break before. But because the likes of Pogba, I mean, I don't know, I mean, everyone has been. But watching Pogba now, as he kind of gazelles beyond entire midfields, the way he hasn't been for months and months and months. And it's like, honestly, he looks like, you know, a man playing against kids sometimes against top quality players. Now, that's always been there. It must always have been there. But you look at him now, and it is ridiculous the way he just charges beyond two, three, four players. None of them even get close to making a tackle on him. And you've destroyed the midfield in 10 strides. And many players can actually do that. I mean, remember, you know, Vieira used to do that now and again. There's been very few of them over the years that have done it. But he's certainly got that. But how infuriating they didn't do it earlier for Man United fans.
Yeah, no doubt. I'm sure Jose Mourinho is looking on, stroking his chin, watching him rampage through. It's rare to have a player who's that physically gifted and also technically gifted, isn't it?
Yeah, unbelievably rare. It's getting a wee bit more common. You know, I think you look at, you talk about a number of players in the past that you didn't think of them as tall physically, you know, and then you stand beside them, like Thierry Henry. I remember thinking the first time I stood beside him and thought, eh?
Yeah.
Now, I sometimes look up like that to a lot of people, but to be fair, he's a monster, you know, and there are a few more like that now, but he's, even for the kind of taller players of the day, of the current groups of players that you see around, he has got absolutely everything you need to be a fantastic footballer. And it was infuriating to watch. You know, and it, the body language is all wrong. But, you know, if that's what's needed to get him going, and if it did come down, and we don't know, but if it did come down to who was the most important for Manchester United, Jose Mourinho or Paul Pogba, and they chose Pogba, there's a half a chance they might have chosen right.
There
if
is,
he keeps
indeed.
On playing like this, because you can't stop him.
Yeah. The other, well, I guess the other aspect of watching a video of Rooney, Ronaldo and Ji-sung Park tearing through the Arsenal defence of old is that the modern-day Arsenal defence had to be susceptible to it as well. And they really were. Unai Emery was being praised a huge amount very recently, and yet it was kind of hard to feel too enthusiastic about things on Friday night from an Arsenal point of view.
Yeah, but I'm just really slow to be harsh on any of those sides. On the day, Arsenal can be brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, their 2-0 win against Chelsea, I thought it was superb. Playing at that sort of pace and that tempo, I thought they were brilliant. Do I think they can play that tempo every week? Absolutely no chance.
Okay.
No chance. They don't seem to have it in them to do it every single week. Now, to be fair, asking any team to peak 60 times a year, which you kind of have to do these days in most of the competitions, it's kind of a massive amount to ask. But I mean, against Chelsea, they looked a real deal. You know, in the run before that, they looked a real deal. But then you could say the same for Spurs. Spurs, exactly. They look phenomenal for a wee while. And then they trip up and they look bang average. Now, I think Spurs have got an excuse because of the amount of players they've had injured as well. But that's why, as soon as you get carried away with any of these teams, and I was thinking about just before the Spurs-Chelsea, I was down at Chelsea-Spurs game for the semi-final of the Carabao Cup, and I thought, whoever loses this game is in massive trouble and it's the end of the world. And whoever wins this game is out of jail free card. And you're thinking, but it's only a game and it's ended up being chosen and decided on penalties. So there was nothing between them. And Chelsea kind of get too carried away because they'd done it against what was basically a scratch Tottenham Hotspur side. But, you know, it's so easy to write these teams off in quite simple terms. It's really easy none of them are much better than any of the others, apart from Liverpool, Man City, who are miles ahead. And it's who acquires best during this transfer window as much as anything else. With Spurs, it's slightly different. It's who they get back. Can they get back those players quick enough? But Chelsea have acquired one that looks as if he could be quite good. But I think they've made quite a big mistake by letting go the one guy who could pick out Higuain all day long. Cesc Fabregas is gone.
Yeah.
And it already looks like a big, big mistake. Because watching him the other day there in the Sunday game against Sheffield Wednesday, his movement was stunning. I remember thinking the same of Morata. Like, that guy's movement is intelligent, perfect. And then after a while, Morata stopped doing it because it just took too long to get the ball up front. We'll see what happens to Higuain. But if Higuain had a Fabregas doing it, or, you know, specifically him, but there's other players that could do it from other teams, it'd have been great, you know, for them. But they don't seem to have anyone who's got that sort of, you know, passing ability apart from David Luiz.
And what type of mover is Higuain? Is he? He doesn't strike. I didn't see the game. He doesn't strike me as making lung bursting runs, Shane Long style down the channels. Is it more short and sharp?
Do you know what? Again, I've watched him over the years, but you know, you've been in games where he's playing and he's scored, and you've kind of thought, oh, he's an annoyance, and you're not 100% sure. So I went back, as I do, and checked out all the goals he scored over the last number of years and looked at them all and studied them all and seen what they look like. And yes, there's a couple of specific strengths he has. He is a hard worker. He's a tireless worker. He's not got lightning pace. His timing the runs is perfect. It's absolutely classic centre-forward play. You know, your Aldridges, your Ali McCoists, your, you know, Rushies, that type of movement, but not lightning quick. But he will go off shoulders. He will turn into areas. He's also, that's one other thing, if you give him the ball anywhere within a 20-yard radius of the goal, he will have one touch. His second touch will be a shot. 100% will be a shot. He won't do any more than that. He will manipulate the ball in one touch, and it will hammer on target. Now, either it'll be blocked, the goalkeeper will save it, or it'll go in the goal. And it's astonishing, these numbers at that. I mean, just watching him do it, he is brilliant. So it's not complicated, but he has got a great ability to manipulate a ball in one touch into a position where he can get a powerful shot away. It sounds dead simple, but it's actually quite difficult.
Right, okay. Because he's almost as famous or infamous for misses in high-profile occasions as he is for all those goals and those predatory instincts, not least the World Cup final, you know, just jumps to mind, unfortunately, for him. But you rate him. You're happy to see him at Chelsea.
Here's the simple thing. He needs to get chances. They need to give him chances. And they need to give him chances quick. That doesn't sound like Chelsea. That doesn't sound like the way they play.
Yeah.
If they can manipulate it into a way that they give him opportunities, he will score a bunch of goals for them. More than Giroud, more than Morata, clearly. But, you know, more than probably most strikers playing in the Premier League. Not all, but most strikers playing in the Premier League just now. If you stop Higuain up front for Manchester City or Liverpool, he's scored an absolute barrel load of goals. No doubt about it. And he doesn't give a stuff if he misses chances. They're generally on target. Yeah. It's seen as a miss. You know, they're generally on target most of the time. The vast majority of it. But I am impressed. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I can remember watching a player playing with a player. It'll come to my mind soon. I played with him. I thought, he doesn't think of anything. He doesn't particularly want to link up. He doesn't want to go and slip anybody through in a pass. He wants to get a ball one touch out of his feet and the ball smashed towards the goal. And the rest of his game could be average or awful. It kind of doesn't really matter because that is the game. Also, he's moving off his shoulders very good as well. I have to give him that. That's really, really good. And he's always looking to make that move. And he's now really intelligent player. But that doesn't... He would... And by the way, he's perfect for the Premier League because he's physical, great attitude as well. Very likeable type of player because of that physicality and that honesty about him. But in the end, in some ways, Chelsea's the worst team for him because they don't do those quick chances like many other teams do.
And is it possible for Sarri to open their eyes and show them the light on this front? Because he's obviously very familiar with what Higuain can do.
I don't know.
He'll try.
It's hard to see. It's very, very hard to see. You know, maybe Hazard adapts and change. He'll maybe, you know, when he's not looking for a goal himself, he might try and get the ball in a little bit earlier. But as we all know, everybody knows it now, and there's no big secret here. They go inside. Hazard goes inside. You know, Willian scored two goals all day. He generally goes inside. For that kind of player, you need to get the ball quickly, get move it wide and get it in. Such as someone like, let's see, Callum Hudson-Odoi.
I feel like you're conducting the orchestra here and I'm following your lead. A brief tangent before we get to him, because I'm curious to see how he played for sure. You know the striker you mentioned who thinks of nothing else? So like there are so many beautiful aspects to football that I would imagine gave you huge enjoyment, not least dribbling and not least a slipped pass through, an assist, I mean, the joy of creating an assist, the joy of unlocking a defence with a piece of trickery or skill, and yes, not finishing the move off, but there is a huge amount of enjoyment in that, I would think. Hitting a 30, 40-yarder pass, some players, you know, you think of Beckham and others would have taken a huge amount of joy from that, or a certain cross where you pick out an area and float it in, and on and on it goes. One-twos, there are so many aspects to football which are probably so expressive and so full of joy. Did you ever look at the strikers who just only cared about one touch and bang and scoring a goal and nothing else and thought that in some respects they're missing out on so much of the good stuff?
Yes, but also I always laughed at the fact that there are some fabulous strikers that do that and maybe not a great deal else. And they're the guys that you generally have as the top pundits in football. Talk about football now. And that's the one thing they've done.
It's totally striking as well. Absolutely. Alan Shearer jumps to mind instantly, you know?
Does it, like, they're the most famous. They're the most costly. They've got the figures all make sense because they've scored X amount of goals. Did they do any of the other parts of the game at all? Generally not. And if they did, they didn't do them particularly well. And at the time when I played, I always thought, well, they're a bit useless, you know, and laughed at them a wee bit. But in the end, they get the last laugh because that's all in the end that counted, you know, in the widest sense. They get the goals, they get the numbers, they get the fame, they get the money.
We're not
so
bitter.
They weren't as stupid, were they? So there's no bitterness at all here. No. As you can tell.
But no, it's totally true. I have looked at Shearer and others, the Shearer types, and look, he was obviously an incredible player. But like, in terms of an appreciation of what a Paul Scholes or a midfield player was doing or what defenders were doing at times, or even just the tactical nuances, I don't really think he cared that much about it. Not to pick out Shearer in particular, but those type of strikers.
Yeah, there's one of the players I worked with was Kerry Dixon, and he was an England international. He's one of the top goal scorers in Chelsea's history. He scored barrel loads of goals in the top level English football. And Kerry didn't have the best of touches unless there was a goal nearby. And then a stunning touch, you know, and there's been players like that. I mean, I'm sure I've told you before about Aldo, the way he used to get the mickey taken out in the Tranmere Rovers. When the five-a-sides, we always used to pick him last. And he'd go mental. He hated it because we thought, no, but you can't play five-a-sides. You can only score. And it was furious. Okay, there was a bit of wind-up going on there with Aldo. I'll give him that. And he did rise to it quite a bit. And he probably knew we were winding him up as well. But there's kind of a vague truth in it with some other centre forwards that's it, that's all they had and all they were interested in. And, you know, if you're going to have one trick, that's the trick to have. So, you know, you look at someone like, as long as they work hard, players don't mind it, you know, as long as they work hard. And if you've gone on and he's done nothing except scored two goals and you've won 2-1, you'll put all with it, you know. Yeah, they will miss a part of that, but they were bred for that one thing. It's like you're talking about the most enjoyable things. You know, if I scored, you know, a decent goal from 20 yards, or else if I took it around a couple of players, drew three others towards me, knew everything was happening, give a 20-yard ball over the top of everyone for a tap-in at the back post to someone who no one else seen running, I'm taking that one every day of the week. I'm taking that assist every day of the week, even not even thinking about it. But for them, no, that means nothing. They're furious because they never scored it.
Yes, no, Alan Shearer would be watching you in puzzlement right now saying, I don't understand. So Callum Hudson-Odoi then, he scored a goal, he's handed in a transfer request. Was he impressive? Chelsea, it seems, have turned down his request and they're going to keep him for the next 4 months, and they figure his value won't drop. He'll still have a year left in his contract and they're hoping that they can convince him to stay. That seems to be the state of play.
That's bargaining at the edge. That really is bargaining at the edge. Look, kids 17 or 18, excuse me, the throat's going a wee bit.
You're okay.
You've got three options here, right? As far as I can see. Now four. Three options were let him go and take 35 million for an 18-year-old kid. It ain't bad. He signs on a new contract. That's great for everybody, but it doesn't look as if he's going to do that.
Mm.
Third option was let him run down his contract, sell him for a pittance, or get nothing for him, and you lose out, and the next club, be it Bayern, gains from all your hard work. Suboptimal in the extreme. Now, if Chelsea feels if they can wait it and push it to the end of the, you know, end of this season and expect him not to sit out the last year, that is taking one hell of a chance. Because they will get some money for him because he's so young and he's been developed. But it will be pennies in comparison to the 35 million. I hope they know what they're doing. Because I'd love him to stay at Chelsea. Or even go out and loan if you need games, you know, to a very top club, be it Bayern, be it Borussia Mönchengladbach, Dortmund, you name it. But the idea of keeping them for a year and a half, even though they don't want them for last year, and eventually getting nothing for them, that would be a dereliction of duty. It really would be.
Do you know anything about him as a personality? Have you heard through the grapevine what kind of fella he is?
Just all the interviews I've watched, all the stuff he does with Chelsea TV, all the stuff he does as a youth player coming through. Seriously sensible young guy.
Okay.
Really likeable. Friendly, open. Not at all the big-headed, money-grabbing type that you hear about. Nothing like that at all. That's not him. That's not the guy.
Okay.
So the guy that you're talking about here is a guy who wants to do the best for his career. He knows his value, clearly. But is he trying to manipulate it to get every penny out of it? No, I think that kid's trying to do what's best for his career. And if he thinks, in front of me, I've got Hazard, I've got Willian, I've got Pedro, I've got Pulisic. You know, it's a lot of players in front of him just now. He wants football right now. And for someone who left Scotland at 19 to go down and play for Chelsea, I know that feeling.
Yeah.
You know, you want to play football at the best level you possibly can, as early as you can.
Somebody is clearly watching as well as listening. Did I just see Pat taking a sip from a whiskey tumbler? Nice for the throat, wonders Neil.
Absolutely.
You work. I had Pat Nevin on a hot whiskey. Beautiful. Somebody says
what? Are you joking?
Not hot, no.
No, not at all. That's, you know, they just whisking a little bit. What, you know, I don't know if it's an Irish saying as well, but certainly a Scottish saying. You should never have whiskey without a little bit of water. And the reverse is the same. I like that saying a lot. I live by it.
Okay, good. Well, listen, you make yourself right at home. Steve wants to say Shearer was actually one of the best crossers of a ball, which, I mean, look, it's true. Shearer might be a bad example because we're thinking of a Ruud van Nistelrooy type here, aren't we? That's more the Shearer whacking free kicks as well.
It does sound like an abuse of centre forwards. There's plenty of centre forwards that are not offended by that. You know, that's what their job is. That's what their game is. That's what they're interested in. Now, I generally always felt the centre forwards weren't the best at making, you know, managers or coaches because they really hadn't considered the rest of the game much.
Yeah.
They really hadn't. You know, they hadn't really worked out what happens in a midfield. A defence, they knew how to beat, but they'd never core worked a defence. You know, they weren't always the best ones. Players that were wide were seeing quite often midfielders who were seeing, you know, movements of everybody, and you were part of a unit. Goalkeepers weren't part of a unit.
Yeah.
And centre forwards often weren't part of a unit. They were just a finisher. Now, it's not the case with them all, because there's some brilliant ones out there as well. But it's an interesting concept, yeah, that the people we're all listening to these days are all just the one guys that done that one job. It's strange.
Yeah, no, it's very noticeable. Steve, who,
I'm on the hot orange now.
No, that's you work away. Steve, who mentioned Shearer, added, also, did you know in the 89-90 season, Hugo Sanchez scored 38 goals, all of them with just one touch for Real Madrid?
That's
true. 38
enough,
goals with one touch each?
That might be the one player in world history that's better at one touch than Frank Lampard. Because Frank Lampard's the best I ever seen at that. If you ever look at his goals, any goals he ever scored, have a look at how many of them were one touch.
Okay.
He's the best at manipulating himself into a position of one touch. So talk about centre forwards, they're good at that, you know, and very good at it. Frank Lampard was off the scale at it, absolutely off the scale at it. And he made it look so easy you thought, oh, it's just another tap-in.
Yeah.
Forgetting that he'd manipulated his body to get a left knee, a right foot, a head, whatever.
Yeah.
Twisting his body and moving his physique in different ways. I remember trying doing it once many years ago for Chelsea TV, actually, working out what percentage of his goals were only one touch. But I couldn't get them all because there were bloody well too many of them.
Yeah.
But it was right up there. It was really? 70, 80% for the ones that I checked. It was just astounding. So, you know, the centre forwards they're big on one touches. But Lampard, certainly I can't remember seeing anyone who was better than him. So I'm talking about, you know, Higuain. He's absolutely brilliant with either one, but two maximum. Lampard never balls with a second one.
It's interesting. That sort of passed me by a little bit, because it's not like he was an especially agile looking fella. It's a different skill set to that. It's reacting to a flight of a ball and getting your foot to a certain height. So it's a whole combination of things.
It's positioning your body. Honestly, there's lots of things in a game that the players that play that I was just jealous of. I wish I had. You know, the people who could time and sort of the ball aerially much better. You know, you feel really good when you've got 360 around you. You know where everything is. I've felt comfortable with that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But running at full tilt, when a ball smashed at full speed in, and it's behind you, and you think, what, you kind of get your body up and you kind of half get there in time. Something happened the other night. I'm trying to think. There was a game the other night I watched. Somebody tried to do it. I'll tell you who it was. It was Ross Barkley. Ball came into the back post. Couldn't get his leg around in time because it had gone slightly behind him.
Yeah.
And I can remember thinking, you've got number 8 in your back, mate, wearing a blue strip for Chelsea. That was in the back of the net if I was Frank Lampard, even though it looks really cumbersome when he does it. You know, he's a good player. But Lampard was miles ahead of anybody else that I'd ever seen. If you ever get a chance, just click on Lampard's goals anywhere on YouTube and have a look at them. You'll be amazed when they're one touches.
No, I'll do that. Okay. There's a text in for you from a Toffees fan, Colin. Could you ask Pat Nevin whether or not Marco Silva should persist with zonal marking or bin it altogether? I have watched every Everton game this season. We're fine in the air on our own corner kicks, but when defending, we win nothing. It's become a joke. I reckon about 99% of Evertonians knew that last set piece against Millwall would end up in the back of our net. Something has to give. Either the manager ditches his faith in zonal or the players learn the basics. Cheers, Toffees fan, Colm.
Yeah, the zone is, I'm the same as everyone else with zonal. I just have always been quite uncomfortable. And every time I say this to anyone who works with it, they just bring out a big bunch of statistics and shows the statistics and say, yeah, we lost 2 or 3 goals, but it was only 2 or 3.
Yeah.
You know, and if it's more than that, and they'll have the statisticians working on it, they'll stop doing it. And if they don't stop doing it, you should get sacked anyway, because you're not looking at your stats. Mm. The only reason it works is if the stats say it does. Remember, for a long, long time, Liverpool, that was a problem for them as well. Mm. Big, big problems for them for years. I remember Chelsea used to abuse it constantly. And they used to say, yeah, but the stats all say that over the season. I remember thinking, well, you don't play Chelsea over the season. You only play them twice in their damned important games and you're losing a hell of a lot of points, lads. So there's certain teams where I think it's probably sensible to adapt out of it. And if you're playing against a team that's really physically strong in the air and they can make, you know, get capital out of it, I'm not sure it's a sensible thing. Just staying the same idea all the time.
There's fairly shocking scenes with the Everton Millwall crowd trouble afterwards, and the picture of the fan who's got a scar down the length of his face, he's destroyed his face. It's absolutely horrific. I mean, it's just, there's not so much any of us can say. We weren't there, we don't know exactly what's happened. And, you know, the Millwall CEO has come out and talked about the Millwall reputation, and they've talked about the work they've done and said, look, Millwall Football Club can't be responsible for educating the whole of South East London and this group of people. We need the authorities, the Football Association, kick it out ourselves, other clubs, rather than threatening everyone with ground closures and saying chuck them out of the cup and ridiculous notions that are going on. We all need to come together, find a way to try and educate people, etc., etc. Football is fantastic. Let's use its place in society to educate people. And on he goes. He says, don't say, oh, let's get Millwall out of the FA Cup. It's not getting us anywhere. This isn't just a Millwall thing. It happens across society. He's right, of course, I suppose, in many ways. And that said, there is a Millwall reputation which seems to endure. There's not so much you can say beyond just the... Like, he's really just ruined his face. It's just, it's shocking.
It's I'll tell you a wee story about that. My early days at Chelsea, we played down at the old Den.
Mm.
And I got food poisoning a couple of days before it, so I couldn't play. But being me, I thought, I'll just go along and go to the game. So I went to the game not feeling particularly well and feeling so unwell that 15, 20 minutes into the game, I sitting in the stand with some Chelsea people, some people who worked at the club, I had to rush down to the loo.
Yeah.
So I ran down to the loo, went to the loo, came back up again, felt terrible. Had to do that a couple of times. Anyway, never thought another thing. Ended up jumping in a team bus afterwards and went back home. The next day, one of our kids in our team, he'd played a couple of first team teams, called Robert Isaacs, was slit in the toilets during the game by a Millwall fan all the way down his back with a Stanley knife, the whole of his back with a Stanley knife. And it just shows it happens, and it's happened all the time. Now, it happened at Millwall there, but it's not just Millwall. You're right. They tend to wait to certain games, these people that do these things. The ones that are noticed, the ones that are on telly, the ones that are high profile. And it is a social cancer that, and now sometimes it was far right people that were doing it. It was a political point they were making. Mm. And other times it was this, you know, the kind of gang culture thing that they had at the inner city firms and all that sort of stuff. None of them are football fans. They're not football fans. Mm. They really do not give a stuff about football. I met a lot of these people, the headhunters at Chelsea when I was there, and the kind of sad remnants of those people are still hanging around now and again. You meet up with them. And I always said, we don't like you very much. I mean, were you at the game? No, we don't go to the games.
Mm.
Go to where the games are, but we don't go to the games. That's how much they care about football.
Mm.
They don't care about football. They use football, and they use football to get themselves that little bit of fame. And the more pictures of that guy that are shown with his face slashed, the happier that moron who did it is. And that's the sadness when you meet these losers. That's how they think. And how the hell you get around that, I don't know. When the best policing you can get, blaming a club. Nah, I'm with Millwall chairman, and I don't see that very often, or CEO. It's not the club. They don't do that. They fight against it.
Mm. When you say the Chelsea headhunters, you mean the ringleaders who went around trying to almost recruit people? Is that what you mean? Or?
Well, they all had firms in those days. It was the inner city firm was one. You know, Tottenham had their fans that were fighters. West Ham, they had their fans that were fighters. And they all had different names. So the headhunters were Chelsea. I think they were Chelsea headhunters. Okay. And then, so they all had their stupid names, which made them feel very, very big and very, very important.
Right.
And I've always, one of my angles that I've never lost was there was a big the thing that you called the casuals that was going on here. There's been so many books written about it, about how they had these fights and how they did this and what it was great. And it was a social cultural thing. You're a bunch of morons, you're a bunch of hooligans. Some of us worked actually quite hard and lost our entire careers in European football because of you. Arses, because that's, you know, it was just, remember what happened in high school.
Yeah,
you know, that was just idiots, you know, that was idiots who were fighting with each other. And why that is now looked back on by some people as a nice part of culture, an interesting part of culture. Not for me. I think the ones that do write those books are ones that do make those programs and those films, I have absolutely no time for them. I'm disgusted to make the films in the first place.
I think that's a fair enough point. Pat, we'll let you go and rest your voice. Thanks so much as ever. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I might just finish this whiskey, okay?
Do. Take your time with it. Enjoy it. All right, see you. Bye, bye, bye.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
Now, you're very welcome back. So we wanted to talk Bundesliga. Borussia Dortmund, 5-1 winners against Hanover at the weekend. They are top of the table, 6 points clear of Bayern. We're joined by Rob Daly, commentator, presenter, who covers lots of Bundesliga games. Evening, Rob.
Evening. I haven't got a whiskey or a fireplace, but I've got a hot water and lemon. Pat's outdone me, I think.
Listen, it's Pat Nevin. He outdoes us all.
Hey. He's the Don.
He really is. Yeah. So, Dortmund then, they're going very, very well. They're 6 points clear. Bayern have had a pretty impressive few years, obviously, and years of dominance. So, what is it, 11 and 12 was the last time Dortmund won there when they won two in a row under Klopp. 6 points clear, they've reached 48 points in record short time and seem to be closing in on a Bundesliga title. Will they do it?
I think so, actually. There is a long way to go. You know, they've played 19 of the 34 games this season, but they have scored 50 goals in that time. They haven't really had a blip like Bayern had. Bayern had a relatively good start to the season, won their first four league games, and won their most recent seven, but had a sort of mid-season blip where they lost to the likes of Hertha and Gladbach and Dortmund, drew home games with Freiburg and others that they really should have beaten. Fortuna Düsseldorf, a famous game where they were 3-1 up and drew 3-3. I just think Dortmund have got the swagger and the confidence to do it. And my one caveat is that Marco Reus has to stay fit, because there are many elements to Marco Reus being a key component of Dortmund's team. It isn't just his goals, it isn't just the way he creates, but the general aura he gives off and the leadership quality he has now as captain of Borussia Dortmund, that if he stays fit, I'm sure they'll win the title.
Mm. And he's linking up again with Mario Götze quite well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're very good friends. Him and Mario Götze, a pairing that was broken up when Götze controversially moved to Bayern under Pep Guardiola. Didn't really happen for him there. He's had his illness issues as well, which has stopped him playing as much he would have liked. They both scored in a game for the first time together in 6 years or something at the weekend in that 5-1 win over Hanover. And I was at Dortmund Gladbach just before the winter break, end of December, and Götze came on, played as a, let's call it, false nine at centre forward, and it was fantastic. The understanding between the pairs good. They've known each other such a long time. Götze hasn't turned into the player we thought he would. Mm-hmm. Granted, he scored a winner in a World Cup final. That's not bad going.
Yeah.
But he hasn't become the poster boy for German football that everybody thought. So it's nice to see him back amongst the goals and looking sharp again.
Dortmund seems, on the face of it, to be a very well-run club, and the atmosphere in the stadium's extraordinary, and the line of managers they seem to have produced who have made their way either to England. Like, we're seeing what the last three, Jan Sewert and Daniel Farke to Norwich, and David Wagner to Huddersfield, and we obviously know about Klopp. And then you've got Thomas Tuchel. It's a fairly extraordinary lineage there. How does the football compare to what we would have seen at that Dortmund team who reached Champions League final a number of years ago? Like, is gegenpressing just entrenched in the Dortmund DNA, or are they going about their business differently?
There's a slight difference, I would say, to what Klopp did, but there's still a high intensity to what Dortmund do. They do press up high up the pitch, as the most energetic and best teams in Germany all do. Mm. That they were a mess of a team last season in terms of you couldn't work out the identity of them. You mentioned the great coaching lineage that we've seen at Dortmund in recent times. Last season was a complete blip. They appointed Peter Bosch after he got to the Europa League final with Ajax, losing to Man United. He was a disaster. Peter Stöger came in, who's a very pragmatic, conservative coach, doesn't suit Dortmund, just had to get them into the Champions League, and then he was off. So it seems the appointment of Lucien Favre, a man they did want at the start of last season, he was number one choice, has re-established what Borussia Dortmund are. And they've been an absolute joy to watch. And I think one thing they did as well, which maybe is a little bit understated, is they've shored up the central midfield. They had Julian Weigl, who was looked at by Guardiola for Man City's midfield, this sort of Xabi Alonso playmaker. They've got two robust central midfielders in there now who can score goals in Thomas Delaney and Axel Witsel, who's linked with Man United for a long time. And I think they've actually, aside from Jadon Sancho's brilliant form, they've been the key men for Dortmund.
Rob, I know you're someone who does a lot of commentaries of Spurs as well. So Dortmund-Spurs in the Champions League final. How will Spurs in their current predicament handle Dortmund?
Yeah, worlds collide. I think Spurs are the moment. Look, the team will take a different shape by the time we get to that, because players will come back from injury for Spurs. It's been a very tough time for them. You know, I've covered every single game this season from a Spurs point of view. Every game you have 5-6 players on that injury list. Mm. And at the moment, of course, it's the best players they've got out at the moment in Kane and Dele Alli. Son's coming back from the Asian Cup. He admitted that he was pretty tired over there and that he wasn't at his best for South Korea as they got knocked out to Qatar. So I think Spurs will be in decent shape. Look, if Kane can get back for the second leg, I'd still be having Spurs as favourites. As good as Dortmund have been, I think fundamentally it's such a settled Tottenham side that when they're all fit, they're one of the best in Europe. They really are. Pochettino hasn't had that chance this season. But it's worth pointing, you know, it's been a difficult few days for Spurs. Out in two cups, the Carabao Cup and the FA Cup. They have 51 points from 23 games. The best ever Premier League tally at this stage. And this is with all the injuries. Yeah. And Son away. Son's missed loads of games this year because of international duty. So I'd have it pretty even, but Spurs to shade it if they can get Kane and Dele Alli back for the second leg.
Okay. And what about Bayern then? I was looking through just the list of Bundesliga winners. And like really, there's never been an era of dominance quite like it in Germany. Obviously, Bayern at various points have won a couple of leagues in a row. But since 2000, they have been Bundesliga champions 13 times. It's been an all-time high for the club. So they're, what, 6 points off? Whatever about the Bundesliga, how are things going? I mean, we're watching Niko Kovac in his first season.
Yeah, I mean, he's had a difficult season. I still don't think fundamentally he's the right coach for Bayern. A new standard was set by Pep Guardiola. Yeah. And, you know, Niko Kovac is not in that category of super coaches that we certainly seem to have a lot of in the Premier League now. I don't know if he quite has the creativity to get the best out of players from an attacking point of view. His Frankfurt team last year, for reference, were quite an interesting team. They won the cup beating Bayern in the final, but they were all about high risk. So they wouldn't be afraid to play it like a long ball because they're big men up front. They didn't win the first knockdown. They pressed the hell out of the ball, won the second one, and we'll get a lot of goals in that way using high wing backs. With a back three centre-backs. Bayern don't play like that, and they're not going to play like that. Mm. So whether Niko Kovac is the right man going forward for Bayern, I don't know. If they don't win the title this season, I'd imagine he'd have to leave because, well, I mean, I can't remember how many Bayern have won in a row. It might be six or seven.
You're going back to 12, you know, so yeah, 13 through to last season.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you've got to win the league now. That's the minimum requirement for being Bayern manager, but the team is without question in transition. And that's why they are, you know, a prominent force in the transfer market right now. They were conservative in the summer, but they're going big right now.
And how did they shape up for Liverpool, do you suspect, Rob?
I think it's a great tie for Liverpool, actually. I do back Liverpool to get through that. Look, Bayern have hit a good run. They weren't fabulous in the 4-1 win over Stuttgart at the weekend. But, you know, it's not a bad scoreline at all. Stuttgart have had a tough season. I think they've won 7 in a row in the league, so they seem to have found their footing in that again. And the win at Hoffenheim the other day was very impressive, actually, after the winter break. But they're still not fluent, and they weren't last year. They won the league with Heinkes coming in to try and save the campaign, but they weren't at their free-flowing best, and the team is ageing. You know, the team is ageing. It's why they are playing Serge Gnabry a lot more. He looks very good. Leon Goretzka, who's coming to midfield, is really starting to impress now. 3 goals in 2 games. They know they have to evolve. You know, I'm really backing Liverpool to come through that tie. Ribéry and Robin are not the force they once were.
Yeah.
You know, they'll push Dortmund all the way in the title race, but I back Liverpool to get past them in the round of 16 in the Champions League.
How's Thomas Muller's form?
Well, he's been an odd one, Thomas Muller. Really since Euro 2016, when he went to that tournament and just couldn't score. I mean, Thomas Muller always scores loads of goals at World Cups and Euros, doesn't he? He's won the top scorer accolade, I think, at a couple of World Cups. But I think fundamentally there's a little bit of Carlo Ancelotti didn't quite know where he wanted to play him. Ancelotti actually preferred Thiago as the man behind the striker. You're never going to play Thomas Muller up front because you've got Lewandowski on the books. So then they were using him wide and, you know, he can play a relatively free role. He's very intelligent, good at picking up space. But for me, he isn't the player that we saw, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when he first broke through as well. For a youngish guy, I don't want to guess his age. I can't remember. I want to say in his late 20s.
Yeah.
He's played loads of football. He has played a tremendous amount of football. So I just think, you know, he's still very good, good enough for Bayern. But he's not quite
where he was. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. He's 29 years of age now, but he does feel like an old 29. He does, doesn't
he?
Yeah, he does.
Feels like he's been around forever.
Across Germany, I mean, so we mentioned Bayern's recent success and 13 times they've won since 2000. Around Germany, are there Bayern supporters who live in every town and every city? Or is there a real anybody but Bayern element across the country?
No, there's a bit of that. I mean, you're going to find, you go around anywhere like Cologne or you walk around Berlin, there will be people in Bayern shirts.
Yeah, okay.
But they are the big bad wolf. They are. They're the team everyone loves to hate, and, you know, that's what winning teams are, aren't they? They've won way more Bundesliga titles than anyone else. Not like we have in England where you've got United and Liverpool out on 20 and 18. I think they're approaching 30, way ahead of everybody. So they're in a different stratosphere.
I think they're 28 to Dortmund's. This would be their ninth if Dortmund can manage.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, it's a big gap.
Okay, listen, thanks a million for filling us in and all that, Rob. Thanks a million.
Pleasure. Great Cheers. To be on. Thank you.
Rob Daly there, who's a Bundesliga commentator, does a lot of Spurs games as well. You'll hear him on Talk Sport presenting too.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.